Marvin Cohen. I give us a 50-year summary of condensed matter theory.
100 years.
Okay, thank you very much. All that talk about water, I had to go out and get a drink of water. I'm very happy to be here to celebrate the 50th anniversary of PRL. And I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. They gave me some instructions. They said to review all of condensed matter theory over the last 50 or 100 years since physical review started 100 years ago. And so I'll do that. And this was my job. And they said that I should focus on the area of how we went from simplified models to computational approaches. And they said it was okay to talk about my own work. So if I sound somewhat myopic in this review, it's because that's part of my instructions. So I thought about it, and I toyed with the idea of just showing you all my rejection letters from PRL. But it was clear to me after thinking about it that I didn't have enough time to do that. And so I will give a prehistory and general review, and the two examples that I'll give will be in nanoscience and superconductivity. Okay, the prehistory, if we go back to Einstein, say a little bit about that, Dirac's challenge, the wonderful review by Sommerfeld and Bethe, and then Fermi's introduction of the pseudopotential. Now for Einstein, if you looked at that list, his wonderful 1905 list, you would convince yourself in a moment that he was a condensed matter theorist. Three of the four, determination, his thesis, the Brownian motion, and the work that he got the Nobel Prize for, which he said was the most exciting work of that year, is all within our domain. And later, he, just 2 years later, which was 100 years ago, and some people, Jorn Grimvall, has said that he felt that this was the first theoretical condensed matter physics paper. This was the famous paper by Einstein on heat capacity, and Debye fixed up the low energy part with his T-cubed law. And the fact that it's still in textbooks is very interesting. I wonder how many papers from this meeting will be around in textbooks 100 years from today. And so he was certainly involved, and he thought more about quantum mechanics than he did about relativity, according to his memoirs. And in 1929, when Dirac and Heisenberg, Schrodinger and so forth, all the pioneers of quantum mechanics, proposed quantum mechanics, and Dirac made this provocative statement. It was a challenge that the physical laws necessary for a large part of physics and all of chemistry were known, and all we had to do was solve the equations. So we've come a long way in those 75 years, or whatever, 80 years, and we have pretty much answered his challenge. And an interesting point between the time of Dirac, and 1929 was a big year for physical review letters too, was the work in 1933, the review article by Sommerfeld and Bethe is just marvelous. If you read it and then look at today's undergraduate textbooks in solid-state physics, you'll see that they had much of what we have, what we teach our undergraduates. And so this work really set the stage. So Born and his students, and Sommerfeld and his students, certainly contributed at the level where they could start thinking quantitatively. And in a more obscure paper, in 1934, Fermi invented the pseudopotential. Amaldi and Segre had been working on excited states of alkali atoms, and Fermi said, in Italian, that who cares about all these oscillations near the core? Let's just get the outer parts of the wave function right, and we can explain excited states. And you'll see that that's the region that's so important for condensed matter. And so that's why many of the calculations I show you will depend only on that part of the wave function. Now, in 1940, Herring proposed the orthogonalized plane wave method. John Slater proposed the augmented plane wave method. And these were the first After Wigner and Zeitz, the first computational approaches where people really began working on trying to compute electronic states in solids. Kleinman and Phillips in the late 50s used Herring's model to develop a pseudopotential approach, which looked a little different from Fermi's, but led in the same direction. And then Phillips suggested that we use coefficients of potentials and empirical data to really get things straight. So that in 1957, when PRL was born, or 58, and BCS was born, and you'll hear from Charlie Slichter about that exciting era, it's really surprising that there were no accurate, detailed electronic band structures for silicon. In fact, Conyers Herring at the March APS meeting some years ago gave a talk on how little we knew about silicon in 1960. And considering how important this material is, it's surprising that at that stage, when you had sophisticated theories of this kind and so many things happening in physics, there was so little known about electronic structure. However, by using these empirical pseudopotentials, within about 5 years of this period where little was known about silicon, you actually could produce, we were able to produce 14 accurate band structures for semiconductors. And those are so precise and accurate, and they had some experimental input that they are still used today. In the 70s, these calculations were extended to actually solve the origins of the optical structure of semiconductors in the visible and ultraviolet regime. And by the 80s, the pseudopotential was constructed from first principles, no experimental input, and it was possible to do structural properties, mechanical properties, phonons, vibrational properties, superconductivity, as I'll show you, and even surfaces and high-pressure problems. And nowadays, from 1900 to 2008, any new discovery in a new material, even the high-TC superconductors, where some of the methods were known not to be completely appropriate, the first thing people do is to do a band structure calculation. And to get some idea, to give you a framework to which to talk about. And I was going to say this is one of the pillars of condensed matter physics, but Gene used that word several times. And so now the same thing happens in the area of nanostructures and in a variety of properties. Okay, so it wasn't that easy. To give you an idea of the attitude around 1970, it's gauche to quote yourself, but I said I'm often asked whether doing physics research using computers is mindless research. My answer at that time is that I could do mindless research without a computer. The situation changed, and to some extent, perhaps too much, because there are many people who will go out and buy these canned programs to calculate things without knowing what's inside, and they have beautiful graphics. And it's really hard to tell whether or not the results are trustable. And of course, within the community of people who are experts, they know, but not everybody knows. And so Jim Chalikowski said that for calculating materials properties, if given the choice between the computers of today together with the physical concepts of the 70s, or the computers of the 70s with the physical concepts, current concepts, I choose the latter. And so we've learned a lot by doing these electronic structure calculations. We learned what's important, what you can throw away, and we learned a lot about properties of materials. So if you go back from the time of, let's say, Beta Sommerfeld to now, what are the conceptual pictures that we have for a solid from the standpoint of a theorist? And there are basically two pictures. I'll argue for two pictures anyway, an interacting atoms picture and an elementary excitation model. In the interacting atoms picture, you think of a solid as a collection of strongly interacting atoms. The particles are the electrons and the nuclei. You know that only electromagnetic forces are important, and therefore this is associated with reductionism. Sounds a lot like particle physics. Tell me the particles, tell me the forces, and I'll tell you everything. However, there's another aspect, which is like more modern particle physics. The elementary excitation model. Here, the particles are mainly quasi-particles and collective excitations. You probe a solid, you look at its responses, and you get emergent behavior. Things happen. And you have to explain those properties in terms of these quasi-particles, which are basically fermions, and the bosons associated with the collective excitations. For example, a quasi-electron, like a polaron, an electron with a cloud of phonons with it. A hole. They haven't found a quark. We don't have any free holes, right? You can't propagate a free hole across the room. It's a concept. It's a way of actually dealing with properties that are emergent, superconducting quasi-particles. Even collective excitations, like phonons and plasmons and magnons, they don't resemble the particles that make them up. So this emergent model is quite important. Now, I'll be talking about the pseudopotential method, but you could use other methods to do the electronic structure calculations. But in this approach, you think of the electronic states that are close, the electrons that are close to the nucleus, the so-called core electrons, plus the nucleus as a core. And so you have a periodic array of cores, and you have valence electrons that can go anywhere, and you assume that those valence electrons are going to be subject to a lowest energy approach. In other words, you find out what the energies are for the electronic system. And the pseudopotential that gives you the interaction of the electrons with the nuclei, it looks very much like an approach that Fermi had. In other words, you take an all-electron wave function, here the 3S radial wave function for silicon, you reproduce it on the outside, and you let it fall to zero, assuming that you can do all this and keep it normalized. And these have been done for the entire periodic table, and there are many places where you can get these potentials. And so once you have that, you have everything. You can use a density functional approach if you want for the electron-electron interactions. And you can actually look as though you have a theoretical microscope to talk about the charge density, the electron density, inside the solid. So here's the covalent bond of silicon. This work was done with Jim Chelikowski, and here's the experiment which was done after the theory. And I heard so many jokes yesterday talking about chemists making jokes about theorists, physics theorists and physicists. I'd like to tell you that I couldn't find a chemist anywhere that believed that the covalent bond in silicon was this localized when we did these calculations. And it wasn't until the experiment came out that, in fact, it went there. And then afterward, Linus Pauling was very happy about it and said, oh, yes. But I couldn't find anyone else. So the other thing that you can do is, as I mentioned, you could calculate all of the structural energy for a given alignment of or arrangement of cores in a system as a function of volume. So for silicon, which I'm focusing on, here you have the minimum energy, and so you can get the lattice constant, you can get the bulk modulus, and there were only a couple of these forms of silicon that were known, the diamond and the beta tin, and all of these others were predicted, and they've all been found. A simple cubic knot, you can see it's above the line, but basically the transition pressures and so forth. And so in this approach, you could calculate, this is an old picture, but you can see that you can get the lattice constant to within certainly less than a percent, and you can also get bulk moduli to within a few percent. So in this particular approach, and sometimes called the standard model of solids, and you can replace what I've chosen here with your own methods, it's now possible for a broad class of solids, clusters, molecules, to describe the ground state and the excited state and those properties associated with emergence and get the electronic structure, the crystal structure, and all of these properties with only the input of the atomic number, the atomic mass, and crystal structures. Okay, my two examples. In nanoscience, the interest for theorists is that you get confinement. So the electrons are more localized and they do strange things. You have reduced dimensionality and you have some symmetry properties that come in that show you some interesting new physics. So the example is, first we can look at a graphene sheet. So think of this as having a carbon atom at every vertex. And if you roll the graphene sheet up so that this A goes to A prime, you've gone over three lattice constants this way and five up this way, you get a 3-5 nanotube. If you look at just the graphene layers, as you heard, and there's a lot of this work going on at this conference, the system has no gap, and this has been known for a long time. And so people notice the relationship between this and a massless Dirac equation, although this has nothing to do with relativity. And the velocity is the velocity of light over 300, so it's a lot slower, the Fermi velocity. And if you look at angular resolved photo emission, you can actually see the bands coming in this way, in a linear way, instead of quadratically, as we usually expect. And we see this Dirac point, and so this system can give rise to very interesting properties. For example, Philip Kim and his collaborators at Columbia have seen the quantum Hall effect in graphene. And I'm going to show you a prediction that Stephen Louis and Young-Woo Sun and myself have made. And this is the only prediction that has not yet been verified in the work that I'm showing you. So this is new. Here's a graphene sheet. And in fact, if you cut it, you get a graphene ribbon. And if you look at the electronic structure, you'll find that the spins are polarized so that at one end, let's say the left end, they're alpha, and the right end, they're beta. So this is up, this is down, or whatever. And so this is what the system looks like. And now if you apply an electric field, not a magnetic field, you can gate the system and you can change the Fermi level. So you can raise all these beta spins up and you can make the whole system beta. And so you can end up tuning a ribbon with an electric field and get 100% polarization. You can reverse the field and you'll reverse the spin polarization. And the electric field depends on the width of the ribbon, and this is why people are interested in graphene. It has such unusual properties. If you move over to the nanotubes, depending on how you construct your nanotube, you'll get a semiconductor or you can get a metal. So for example, if you have an 8-0 nanotube, here you have a semiconductor and a 7-1 is a metal, and you can connect them up if instead of having 2 6-fold rings, you have a 5 and a 7-fold ring. And this is a Schottky barrier, and it rectifies, and this has been verified experimentally. So for miniaturizing electronics, there's a lot of interest in nanotubes. There's also interest in using them as sensors so that you can actually, by just measuring the current, you can functionalize the tubes and tell what molecules are falling on the tube. So there's a lot of interest in carbon nanotubes. I might emphasize that there are other nanotubes. The boron nitride nanotubes, which we were able to predict theoretically, are insulators independent of their chirality. And there are many things that you can use them for. You can put C60s inside, these so-called P-pods, and build structures of C60 that have not been seen in nature. But because you're building them in a confined geometry, and you heard a little bit about confining water before, you build very interesting structures. So these have there's a lot of interest in these systems. Okay, my last example is superconductivity. Let me give you my personal view that there are two classes of superconductors, the BCS superconductor, which is pairing plus phonons, all the conventional metals, whatever that means, lead, zinc, so forth, are in this class, C60. Some of the organics seem to be BCS superconductors, dope semiconductors, and magnesium diboride, and so forth. Then there's exotic, and I put BCS here because they're still pairing, and we have the copper oxides, the heavy fermion systems, and some of the organics. Back in 64, when I was trying to get people to measure superconductivity in semiconductors, and we actually got this first superconducting oxide, all we had to go on was from a transition temperature expression was the BCS equation, which Charlie will talk about BCS theory. And there's this little NV parameter. It's about 0.3 for niobium. The Debye temperature is about 300, and you get 11 degrees. But if you change it to 0.03, like for a semiconductor, TC went down to 10 to the minus 12 Kelvin. So the point is, at that stage, we didn't know the electronic structure of the normal state well enough to calculate, to put it in to these systems. And also the theory of BCS, theory of superconductivity, which was enhanced by using quantum field theoretic methods, particularly in the Migdal-Eliasberg formalism, could give us the pairing and give us functions that we could actually calculate from first principles. So this alpha squared F function, which is essentially an electron-phonon interaction times phonon density of states, involves the electron-phonon matrix element. And I'm going to come back to that. And this is a very important part of superconducting calculations. Okay. Since we could calculate everything for silicon, we went back and looked at higher pressure forms of silicon, which are metallic. So we predicted that there'd be a simple hexagonal and a hexagonal close-pack form. And then we could predict its lattice constant and its electronic structure. We could even predict its electron-phonon interaction and say that it would be superconducting in this range. And as a function of pressure, it would go down and then go into another phase which had a lower transition temperature. And Gerard Martinez and his collaborators at Grenoble were the first to find it. And using a diamond anvil, Peter Yu and his group at Berkeley followed this curve through. So for a while, I used to love saying that silicon is the best understood superconductor. But magnesium diboride came along, not predicted by anyone I know, and it was a shock. But you could go back and apply the full Eliasberg, Migdal-Eliasberg theory, and several people got involved getting the electronic structure. And you could get the transition temperature, the isotope effect for both the boron and for the magnesium. You could calculate the electron phonon lambda, the renormalization lambda, and compare it with heat capacity. You could calculate the phonon spectrum. And the input of mu star, which you could calculate separately, but not accurately at this point, even if you varied mu star between 0.1 and 0.14, which was a huge variation, you would get TC going from 37 to 41. So I think that at this stage, MgB2 as a BCS superconductor is one of the best understood superconductors we have in many ways. It has a complicated Fermi surface, and you can calculate the energy gap on various parts of the Fermi surface, and you can show that on these red cylinders, it's about 7 MeV, and it's down between in the 2 to 3 MeV range on the rest of the body. And you could calculate it as a function of temperature. And I believe that every measured property of MgB2 is explained at this point, tunneling and all the rest. Now, I may be wrong, there may be some new experiments, but as far as I know, it's okay. So the usual question, if you're so smart, how come you ain't rich? And the question is, how do you raise the TC? You want to get to a higher temperature. And everything we've done to MgB2 has made the temperature either increase a little bit, but mostly go down. And unfortunately, this is the result that's consistent with experiments. But we're learning why MgB2 is a good superconductor and trying to do a better job. There's a myth around that you can't get high TCs out of phonons, and you can. This is not me coming out of the closet and saying that the cuprates are electron-phonon superconductors. I am not saying that. I'm just saying that it is possible to get high TCs from phonons, and this is the transition temperature of the Debye temperature as a function of coupling. The problem is that people use the Macmillan equation, which cuts off and saturates. But if you do the full Eliasberg theory, or if you use some of these approximations by Crazen, Barbie, and myself, you find that at high TCs, you get to this Allen-Dines range, which goes like the square root of lambda. So you can get a high transition temperature superconductor. So how do you do it? This is some work done by one of my students, Jonathan Musa. If you go to the strongest coupling systems, the transition temperature should go like the square root of this. And so you want a mass that's light, And then you want this thing, this eta, to be high. Now you can figure out what eta is because if you put omega squared down the bottom, m omega squared would be the lattice spring constant. So eta is an electronic spring constant. So lambda, everyone's searching for higher lambdas, it's the electronic spring constant over the lattice spring constant. So you want a soft lattice and you want a strong electron spring constant. And so to do that, you want to go to very strongly bonded materials and you want light masses, and that would take you to Nyman. And it sounds strange that you would think of Nyman in this way, but now people have doped Nyman, and here was the original paper where Nyman was down at a fairly low temperature, but they have gotten boron-doped Nyman up to about 11 degrees now from 4 degrees. And so in order to calculate this, we have to go back and calculate that electron-phonon interaction accurately. And this is work done by a postdoctoral in our group, Feliciano Gustino, and also Stephen Louis. And the idea is that if you calculate the electron-phonon interaction in the usual way, you have to calculate millions of points to get G. But if you switch it over to a Wannier representation, then you can actually calculate G by looking at the motion of an atom and then go back and get the block G and then do these calculations that were extremely difficult before. So, for example, you can say, here's a matrix element of the electron-phonon interaction. Here's a wave function over here. An electron is sort of sitting over here in a Wannier scheme. Another electron is over here in a Wannier scheme. And here's an atom that's wiggling. This is a real space pairing picture for superconductivity. And you can calculate this and calculate the electron-phonon interaction. And this was done for Diamond, and it's consistent with the experiments so far. And we decided to try something else, and that was to look at the coup rates, but to look at the normal state kink that comes because an electron has a self-energy, the polaron effect, an electron interacting with phonons to see how strong the electron-phonon interaction is. So here's an electron, emits a phonon, takes it back, the simplest self-energy diagram, and here's the electron-phonon matrix element. It's the phonon-Green's function, the electron-Green's function. And this, because the electron travels through the system, like a polaron, carries a strain with it, the mass gets bigger, and it gives you an enhanced mass of the Fermi surface, which is called a kink. And these have been observed in the angular resolved photoemission data and interpreted as signatures of strong electron-phonon coupling. And that's what we expected. So, for example, here's some data on lanthanum, strontium, copper oxide. And you can see that there's a deviation. Now, the experimentalists got a large deviation. In recent discussions with the experimentalists, they're going back and trying to figure out whether this baseline is a problem, that they didn't have the free electron or the non-phonon part correct. But if we calculate this self-energy, this is the real part of the self-energy, is a function of energy. The experiments, depending on doping, they give you something that's fairly large. And if you had something this large, you expect that the pairing interaction in these systems is probably pretty strong due to phonons. But we're getting about 1/7 of what the experiment is. So based on the conclusion with this Wannier formalism for calculating electron-phonon self-energy, the coupling's about 1/7 of what's needed to observe the RP's kinks. Now, our numbers could be bigger if we include a correlation, but they don't seem to be much bigger. And the experiment could be smaller depending on how they interpret the data. But at this point, there's a difference between experiment and theory. So I wanted to give you an example that also included, let's say, these superconductors. But we are not doing first principles calculations of the pairing in the coup rates. We've just done this. For some reason, this won't move. Okay, so let me get back to Einstein to close my talk. In Einstein's view, if you look back at the title of his 1905 photoelectric paper, paper, and then talk to the Einstein historians, which I did to try to understand, you know, where he was coming from. The title was Concerning the Generation Transformation of Light from a Heuristic Point of View. Now, that's obviously a translation from the German. And by heuristic, he was really thinking of a model. So he was really thinking of more of an emergent view, particularly in his work in relativity. He really jumped to the answer and did it in a very different way than Poincaré was doing. And he had a lot of discussions with Henri Bergson. Bergson was a Frenchman who, in his youth, was an excellent mathematician. He had done some very good mathematics. And then he saw the light and switched to philosophy and talked about emergence. And he said that all senses are images. In other words, we look at things and we interpret them, and then the physics really comes in on how we interpret them. Unfortunately, Bergson thought relativity was wrong at the beginning and argued with Einstein, but then when he saw the light, he became a big proponent of relativity. And this unusual man went on to win a Nobel Prize in literature. So from math to philosophy to literature. So Einstein was influenced, but throughout his life, he oscillated between reductionism and emergence. And so both these A times reductionism and B times emergence, they were both functions of time, depending on the problems that he worked on. So what I would suggest to condensed matter theorists is that if a student asks you whether or not you're a reductionist or you believe in emergence, you should say the same thing that you say when they ask you if light is a particle or a wave, you say yes. And so because with this standard model of interacting atoms and with elementary excitations, taking in a reductionism and an emergent point of view, theorists now can explain and even predict ground state and excited state properties of many condensed matter systems. But the experimentalists still make the decisions on what's right. All decisions in physics are made by experiment, as Val Telegdi taught me when I was a graduate student at Chicago. And I still believe that. But many experimentalists say that they make all the major new discoveries. They discovered superconductivity, and they discovered magnetism, and they discovered everything. But perhaps with many of these new methods, we may get in on that discovery part and contribute. And so let me close by wishing Physical Review Letters a happy birthday and express my thanks to the people who made it such a big success.
Okay, we have time for a couple of questions, I think. Do we have a question for Marvin? Well, maybe I'll ask you a question. It's a journal-related question, and it relates to Gene's talk as well. Maybe Jack can shed light on this. I've been keeping a running list, and I've seen the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the Journal of Chemical Physics, Nature Physics, 1PRL, Science, Nature, and then a lot of talk about Einstein, who never published in PRL. So I'm dying to hear from Jack about the future of scientific publishing. Can you comment on that, Marv?
Well, Einstein, as you know, had a run-in with Fizrev, and he was wrong. And the referee was right. Einstein was wrong. Then Einstein sort of, he was sort of a litter box and then sort of disappeared. And he went ahead with the new view, which was really the view of the referee. So I think that sometimes people who get rejections, not me, cease to publish in those journals. And I've heard people say, I'll never publish another paper in such and such. And of course, 2 years later, they're publishing again. And it's, you know, evaluating people's work is really very difficult. Einstein himself went through 7 thesis proposals before his thesis was accepted. And on the 7th, it was accepted. And he had criticisms from the professors. And the thesis that he proposed were E equals mc squared, measuring the speed of light, actually the determination of the sizes of molecules, which ended up being his thesis. And so he did not take rejection in a very light way. And so I think the fact that he didn't go on to publish more in Physical Review. Now, I guess that the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paper, that was later. Was that PhysRev?
Yeah. It was Physical Review, yeah.
And that was PhysRev. And that's an extremely important paper. And he did more in condensed matter. He did Bose-Einstein effect. He dabbled a little in this theory of general relativity, but you can forgive me.
Well, I know you have another question.
Yeah, Lynn. Okay. Lenz said that I did not mention the two words density functional. I thought I said it once, where you can do the electron-electron. Actually, to develop all those Mann structures and the rest and to get the optical properties of semiconductors, we didn't need density functional theory. Density functional theory came afterward, after the problem was solved. And in fact, to get the surface states and to get structural properties, at the beginning, we used Slater approach and Wigner approach to correlation and exchange, and we were able to get all those. All our modern work, we used density functional approaches. But to solve the problems in the early days, we didn't.
Okay, well, I think we should move on to the fourth talk, and thank the speaker again.